From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is detained after evading house arrest to attend a Moscow protest.
He's a very prominent critic of President Putin. He's an opposition figure, and he's been an activist against corruption for many years.
Air Asia confirms that recovered debris and bodies found in the Java Sea are from its missing plane. And scientists celebrate how their research helps medical patients. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been detained by police shortly after he joined protesters in defiance of his house arrest sentence. Earlier today, a Russian court had found the political activist guilty of defrauding a French cosmetics company of at least $500,000. The court gave the 38-year-old lawyer and blogger a 3.5-year suspended prison sentence, far lower than the 10 years sought by prosecutors. Navalny's brother Oleg received the same sentence, but was ordered to jail. Navalny's defense team said it will appeal the verdict. Speaking directly to the judge, Alexei Navalny condemned his brother's sentence. Oleg Navalny has never played a role in the Russian opposition movement. The court was originally supposed to deliver the verdict on January 15th, but moved up the date with no explanation of its decision. Earlier today, before Navalny's detention, VOA correspondent Daniel Scharf in Moscow was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty about Mr. Navalny's background leading up to this latest court case.
Well, he's a very prominent critic of President Putin. He's an opposition figure, and he's been an activist against corruption for many years. He was actually a mayoral candidate a little over a year ago here in Moscow and came in second place. But he's also, because of his outspoken criticism of the government, of President Putin and authorities, he has been charged on numerous occasions with fraud, embezzlement, and so forth, and has been spent a little bit of time in jail. He's been arrested, but mostly he's been kept under house arrest, especially since the beginning of this year, since February. And now this current verdict was about an alleged fraud case, and he has been found guilty along with his brother, Oleg. But while Alexei Navalny, was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison suspended, which means just more or less a continuation of his house arrest, his brother, Oleg, has received jail time for 3.5 years, which came as quite a surprise to a lot of the watchers of the trial.
What about the timing of this verdict? I understand it was moved up a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is another thing that really struck everyone. Yesterday, the court suddenly announced first to Navalny's lawyers and then publicly that they had already come up with a verdict. And so they would be announcing it the following day, which is today, rather than on January 15th, as they had originally planned. Now, that came as quite suspicious to a lot of people because Navalny's supporters had planned a very large protest just outside of the Kremlin in support of him on January 15th. And the number of people signing up to attend that protest had reached over 33,000 in just a matter of a couple of weeks. So a lot of people felt, a lot of analysts and reporters and observers, that this was an obvious attempt to try and, get the verdict out before those protests, before people have a chance to organize and get out on the streets of Moscow.
Of course, this comes after a much earlier high-profile trial involving a Russian businessman, Mr. Khodorkovsky.
Yeah, and this is actually coming on the anniversary of that that verdict. So it certainly seems to have some symbolic timing. But the overall impression that most people are getting is, and outside of the court today, there was a lot of reaction that this sentencing of Alexei Navalny's brother Oleg, while he only received, Alexei himself only received a suspended sentence, seems to be an old Soviet tactic, an old KGB tactic, in fact, of going after the family rather than trying to make a martyr out of the person that you want to shut up. So that certainly is a big concern, and we're probably going to see a lot more political analysts making those same remarks. Certainly that's what Alexei Navalny's supporters, his lawyer, his spokesperson are saying, that this appears to be very much a tactic of going after the family to try and shut up the man that you don't want going public against you. And we have to remember, of course, that President Putin is a former KGB operative himself. So this could very much fall into that that pattern.
This verdict comes down as Ukraine's President, Mr. Poroshenko, has indicated that he'll meet Mr. Putin next month regarding the crisis in Ukraine. Also, Russia is trying to come out of a spiral with regard to its economy and its currency, the ruble. Any linkage at all with these events?
Well, certainly it's going to be, it's always a good thing whenever the leaders of Ukraine and Russia are willing to talk. At least it's going to hopefully calm down the situation in eastern Ukraine, where we've seen some serious fighting in the last year that's killed thousands of people. So these talks in Astana in Kazakhstan next month, which are coincidentally timed for January 15th, when the original verdict was going to happen, this is it's a good sign when they're sitting down at the table rather than exchanging accusations. As far as any other linkage between the economy and what's been going on in Ukraine and the trial, it's really not directly linked in any way that we can see. Of course, whenever there is any sort of political instability inside Russia or any sort of indication that the rule of law is not prevailing, it does have an effect on the markets. And we did see a slight drop in the value of the ruble when the verdict came in this morning against Alexei Navalny and his brother.
That's VOA's Daniel Scharf in Moscow. He spoke before the detention of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny by Russian police. Indonesian officials have recovered at least 40 bodies from the sea near the wreckage of an Air Asia passenger jet that crashed during a storm on Sunday. As Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, the accident is the third for a Southeast Asian carrier this year amid the fast-paced aviation sector growth in recent years.
Indonesian aircraft spotted the debris in the Java Sea about 10 kilometers from where the Air Asia Flight 8501 was last reported on radar on Sunday. The shallowness of the sea, between 40 to 50 meters deep, is expected to aid efforts to recover the aircraft and vital communications data, including the voice recorder. The images of the discovered wreckage were beamed into the waiting room at Surabaya Airport, where family members had gathered to await news of the rescue efforts. Many wailed and screamed at the sight of the debris, and also the first bodies to be seen bobbing in the Java Sea. The Airbus was on a routine two-hour service route from Surabaya, Indonesia, to Singapore, when the aircraft encountered heavy storms at the height of the monsoon season. Initial investigation of the cause of the crash blames severe weather for the latest tragedy. The Airbus 320 was flying its normal route Sunday when the pilots asked air traffic controllers to go 1,800 meters higher to avoid a large thunderstorm. Reports say clearance was delayed as other aircraft were in the area, but within minutes of that communication, all contact was lost with the Airbus. Hugh Ritchie, chief executive of Sydney-based Aviation Consultants International, said satellite images highlighted the storm's ferocity.
That's pretty ferocious. I mean, it was heavy weather, very strong updrafts and very strong downdrafts, quite sufficient to cause the aircraft some severe distress. And, whilst it may not destroy the aircraft, and would be stressed, could cause the aircraft to break up in the air. Now, I would assume that either icing or a combination of icing and severe turbulence would have caused this accident.
The chief executive of the Malaysian-based low-cost carrier Air Asia, Tony Fernandez, expressed his deep condolences over the tragedy. The flight was operated by the Indonesian affiliate of Air Asia. Air Asia, one of the most successful low-cost operators, has subsidiaries in Thailand and the Philippines. Altogether, the group has over 170 aircraft amid the fast-growing aviation sector in Asia, where there are 1,600 aircraft operating in the region. The tragedy is the third in 2014 for a Southeast Asian carrier after the still-to-be-recovered Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 lost in March on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. In July, Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 crashed in eastern Ukraine. The search for this latest missing airliner involved some 30 ships and 15 aircraft from at least three countries. On Wednesday, families of the victims are to be flown from Surabaya to Belitung Island, located on the east coast of Sumatra, to formally identify victims from the latest air tragedy. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
4 years after the uprisings that shattered the decades-old status quo in the Middle East, 2015 promises to be another year of tumultuous change, presenting new challenges for U.S. foreign policy leaders. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell looks ahead to expectations for the region in the new year.
Just a year ago, few people had heard of the Islamic State terrorist group. But after a lightning-quick takeover of large parts of Syria and Iraq, the jihadis have been labeled an imminent threat to many other countries. Hundreds of airstrikes appear to have slowed IS momentum, and analysts like Paul Salem of the Middle East Institute predict more gains in the new year.
I think the fight against the Islamic State will progress in Iraq. I think Iraq, between the Kurdish army and the National Army based in Baghdad, with strong U.S. support, will make progress in 2015.
But progress looks less likely in Syria, where the U.S. is planning to train moderate rebels. Former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, says more needs to be done.
If we don't help friends on the ground very quickly, there will be no choice in Syria except Bashar al-Assad on one side and jihadi extremists on the other.
IS caught the West's attention with gruesome beheadings and other atrocities. Johns Hopkins professor Daniel Serwer says IS has gone too far.
I think I would bet on it to lose some territory because I think it's making serious mistakes, especially in Iraq, where it has slaughtered members of several Sunni tribes.
The Pentagon says there is evidence IS fighters have begun to move into Libya, where chaos has created a security crisis. General David Rodriguez leads the U.S. Africa Command.
People coming for training and logistics support right now as for training sites, and that's what we see right now. As far as a huge command and control network, have not seen that yet.
There is ongoing political turmoil in Yemen, which has seen several changes of leadership in recent months. Members of the Shiite Muslim Houthi movement are battling fighters from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Again, Paul Salem.
The long look indicates that the Middle East in this century is going to be a very turbulent and unpredictable place.
Analysts say the raging wars in the Middle East are attracting a growing number of foreign fighters. For those trying to combat radical Islam, the challenges are increasingly complex. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama says as he enters the final 2 years of his presidency, and with the economy stronger at any time since taking office in 2009, he's able to focus on what he calls long-term projects in domestic and foreign affairs. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Mr. Obama, in an interview on U.S. public radio, also says he won't rule out improved relations with Iran and cites Myanmar and Tunisia as examples where democracy has a chance to advance.
In remarks to the U.S. public media organization NPR broadcast on Monday, Mr. Obama says his executive actions in recent weeks on immigration and Cuba were the result of years of work. He says he had foreseen 2014 as a breakthrough year, and after 6 years in office and an improving economy, he finally had the opportunity to deal with some thorny issues.
But at the end of 2014, I could look back and say we are as well positioned today as we have been in quite some time economically, that American leadership is more needed around the world than ever before. And that is liberating in the sense that a lot of the work that we've done is now beginning to bear fruit. And it gives me an opportunity then to start focusing on some of the other hard challenges that I didn't always have the time or the capacity to get to earlier in my presidency.
Mr. Obama says he now wants to focus on long-term projects, such as making sure all Americans benefit from an improving economy. And on the international front,
even as we're managing ISIL and trying to roll them back and ultimately defeat them, even as we've been executing the drawdown in Afghanistan in a responsible way, the moves like the Cuba diplomatic initiative are ones that I want to make sure I continue to pursue, partly because, frankly, it's easier for a president to do at the end of his term than a new president coming in.
When asked if he envisions opening an embassy in Tehran as he restores diplomatic ties with Cuba, Mr. Obama says the two countries are different. He says after 50 years of the same policy, it was time for a change with a tiny country that does not pose a significant threat. He calls Iran a large, sophisticated country with a history of state sponsorship of terrorism that is hostile to Israel and trying to develop a nuclear weapon. He says improved relations with Tehran will hinge on a verifiable nuclear agreement. Over time, he says, sanctions could be removed, Iran could be reintegrated into the international community, and that would serve as the basis for improving relations. The United States has not had diplomatic relations with Iran since 1980, after Iranian activists seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took its staff hostage. The U.S. and five other nations have been negotiating for a peaceful civilian Iranian nuclear program. Iran has long denied its program has a military purpose. Despite reaching an interim deal in November 2013, the two sides have failed to reach a comprehensive agreement and extended the talks into next year with a new deadline at the end of June. As for advancing democracy, human rights, good governance, and the rule of law, Mr. Obama points to Myanmar, also known as Burma, and Tunisia, where transformations appear to be underway. He says these are countries where the U.S. can be opportunistic and do everything it can to help. But when it comes to nation-building in Libya, Syria, and Iraq, Mr. Obama refers to them as generational projects where the U.S. can help but cannot do it for them. As for Russia and its actions in Ukraine, the president says steady sanctions pressure is making the Russian economy sufficiently vulnerable and increasingly difficult to manage. Mr. Obama also says following costly conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, he wants to focus U.S. resources at home, rebuilding schools, roads, basic science, and research. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists have been experimenting with four-legged robots for years, trying to see if they could be used as pack animals for carrying heavy loads over difficult terrain. But the machine's power requirements limited their potential. That's changed with a running robot designed by a group of engineers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that operates on batteries rather than heavy gasoline-powered engines. VOA's George Pudich reports.
Scientists say their robots will soon be able to run like cheetahs. But for now, the different technologies that will bring them closer to everyday life are still being tested. One of the obstacles continues to be power consumption. These complicated machines are still relatively heavy, and their numerous motors require a lot of energy to run. The most powerful among them are either tethered to a power source or have a gasoline-powered generator on board. But engineers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have designed a 30-kilogram cheetah-like robot that is light enough to run on batteries.
This robot can actually jump about 40 centimeters high, and it can land very safely, and it can run a sprint because of the special motor technology we developed.
Sangbae Kim, director of MIT Biomimetics Robotic Lab, says the robot needs only about 700 watts of power. Its limbs and other parts were made in a 3D printer and reinforced with a strong, lightweight plastic called Kevlar, used for modern military helmets and body suits.
The frame has to be very light and then very stiff. So we designed this frame to handle these high forces and then high shock.
But the development of MIT's robot is not without setbacks. Its limbs must sustain tremendous force, and sometimes they break. Kim says another special feature is the custom-made motor controller.
It's also designed by us because none of the commercially available product can handle this kind of power.
Researchers say the new technologies used on this robot may find their way to artificial limbs, as well as other high-tech machines being developed to replace humans at back-breaking jobs. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
The Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on New York's Long Island may be relatively unknown to the public, but it's highly revered among biologists, geneticists, and other life science researchers. VOA's Adam Phillips attended the lab's Double Helix Award ceremony in New York for our report.
It was evening dress only at an ultra-posh Manhattan venue where many of America's scientific and philanthropic elite gathered to honor three whom the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory deemed worthy of the 2014 Double Helix Medals. They're awarded each year to recognize those who've made outstanding contributions to the human understanding of genetics and the life sciences.
Tonight is not only a celebration of science and the people who support science, but I think an expression of the types of research that we do that is having an enormous impact in lots of different fields.
Bruce Stillman succeeded DNA co-discoverer James Watson as the lab's president in 2003.
For instance, just think about the world population. It's growing at a fairly significant rate. And how are we going to feed all of those people? And how are we going to create the energy that's needed to sustain our population over the next 100 or 200 years? We believe biology is going to be a major, major input in that, and genetics can have a major impact in those areas. One of our scientists has recently developed crops that actually double the yield of fruit, just purely by understanding the timing of flowering. And that's an amazing discovery. It's going to revolutionize agriculture.
But it's the genetics within humans, not just the genetic relationship between humans and other life forms, that make up most of the research work done at the lab, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas.
The research that we do in biology can be categorized into a few separate categories. Genetics and genomics research, where we are studying genes and the human genome, the strand of DNA that makes you, you, and me, me, and then taking that information and translating it into understanding diseases like cancer, which is a genetic disease, understanding diseases like autism, like schizophrenia, which are genetic diseases, understanding other types of genetic functions in our body that would impact things like diabetes or obesity.
Matthew Methelson of Harvard University was awarded a Double Helix Medal for his discoveries on DNA replication and the evolution of sexual reproduction, among other things. He recalled how his love for biology and genetics was first aroused.
As a very young child, I wanted to understand what makes things alive. How could you take ordinary dust or inorganic matter and put those atoms together and get something that was living? And that we know now. That is one of the great accomplishments of modern biology. We know about DNA. We know how it replicates itself. We know how it controls the functions of cells and how cells develop to form whole organisms, their body pattern, and all that.
Marlo Thomas also garnered a medal. Already famous as a film and television star, best-selling author, and co-founder of Ms. Magazine, Thomas is widely acclaimed in her role as the National Outreach Director for the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, a Midwestern facility that combines world-class medical research with free, compassionate care to kids with cancer and other genetic diseases.
Hope is our message. Children come from all over the country, all over the world, with death sentences from other hospitals. It's not that these other hospitals aren't good. They're good hospitals, but they're only working with what they know. We're working with what they don't know. We're working with what we don't know because we're a research center and a treatment center under one roof. So we're really finding we're studying disease, and then we make kids better too.
Families also have a place in the work of Double Helix honoree and National Book Award recipient Andrew Solomon. His bestseller, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, examines ways that Down syndrome, schizophrenia, autism, and other genetic conditions play out within families. Indeed, public education about biology and genetics is a key element of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory's mission. Its on-site programs host thousands of school children every year, and it maintains several satellite centers around the world. Now more than ever, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas, cutting-edge research goes hand-in-hand with an informed and engaged public. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Sounds like some amazing work going on there. Well, thanks for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams.
VOA1.